Welcome to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Sarah Gustavus. Here in New Mexico, we've all heard or read in the paper stories about repeat drunk driving offenders who've been arrested multiple times. And maybe you know someone who struggled for years with drug or alcohol addiction and can't seem to get clean. They do well for a while, then they end up in court and in jail again. Once someone is in jail, there's time to think about what they've done, but treatment isn't often available, even if a person really wants it, or it's limited. We'll talk more about that in a few minutes. Today, we're going to spend an hour looking at recovery courts across the state. These courts focus on treatment instead of jail, but there are consequences for people to follow through on orders from the courts as they seek to achieve and maintain sobriety. Are you a graduate of recovery court? Can you share your experience with us today? What do you think about the idea of focusing on treatment instead of jail for people struggling with addiction? Would that be a good or bad thing for New Mexico? Join the conversation today by calling 877-899-5866. You can also email your comments to callinshow@kunm.org. With me in studio this morning is Peter Bokert, statewide drug court coordinator in New Mexico. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Also, Judge Edward Benavides from the DWI Recovery Court in Albuquerque. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
We also have Daniel Blackwood, Executive Director of the Evolution Group. Glad to have you with us, Daniel.
Good morning, Sarah.
And we have Judge Renee Torres on the line this morning. Judge Torres is preparing to take over the Urban Native American Healing to Wellness Court in Albuquerque, and she's a member of Isleta Pueblo. Welcome, Judge Torres.
Good morning.
Peter, I want to start with you. Let's make sure we're all on the same page as we begin this conversation. What is a recovery court?
Well, that's not a term I normally use. I use the generic term of drug court, and I'll explain what that means. But a drug court is an attempt by the criminal justice system to deal with repeat criminal offenders where the repeat criminal activity is driven by their underlying substance abuse, addiction, or mental health issue. So it is a team-based effort to coordinate treatment as well as behavior change. At heart of a drug court is a treatment program because we recognize that addiction is a disease, needs 9 to 12 months of continuous treatment if that addiction is to be clearly addressed and to be have a successful intervention and hope for recovery for that individual. It is a behavior modification program because that individual who's been suffering through addiction all that time leading up to that repeat criminal activity needs to change their lives. They have to get clean. They have to maintain abstinence. And that's going to require quite a significant change in the focus of their lives. So there's intensive supervision. There's random and frequent drug testing, as well as sanctions and rewards for positive behavior and sanctions for noncompliant behavior. And all of that, that treatment program within a behavior modification program is administered by a court of law because they're only in the drug court or the recovery court because they have broken the law and done so repeatedly and so must be held accountable for their actions.
Daniel, that's one thing I wonder when I first heard about this idea of drug court or recovery court. If someone goes to jail for a period of time, they're not going to be able to use. And why can't they just maintain that once they get out? Why can't that be the beginning of sobriety?
Well, it's just not that simple. I think that what happens is we're talking about an adaptive response that an individual has developed to deal with their lives, which is the result of a number of factors coming into play at a time when, you know, they needed some way to regulate themselves. And that's something that you have to come to understand with the individual. They have to learn they have to discover their own inner motivation for wanting to change their lives. So what Peter's describing, I think, is a macro view of how we're addressing the social issue through this model. But where the rubber meets the road is when the individual is faced with the challenge of giving up that adaptive coping mechanism or making choices about it. So we have to meet them in the chairs and in the wellness therapies that we bring forward for this population.
What do you mean adaptive? What do you mean by that? What does that look like when someone that's going to come to you for treatment and work with you?
Sure. Well, so individuals very often are coming in with trauma. A fair percentage of the time with a full-blown diagnosis of PTSD. They have found this particular drug or alcohol to cope with the way they feel inside. And they're not just wanting to necessarily give that up. They don't know what else can help them. And, you know, for a little while, that drug or that alcohol does work to some degree, and then it has horrible consequences. So that's what you're dealing with when an individual comes in, is their motivation to want to give that up and to try something different.
Thanks for that. And for folks listening in today, have you successfully completed a drug court program? What did you learn? What did you think would happen to you if you had not gone through that program? We want to hear from you today. The number to call, 877-899-5866. We also want to hear from folks who think this might be a good thing for someone in their family or a friend or someone in their community. What questions do you have about drug courts? 877-899-5866. Judge Benavides, I imagine there's some skepticism out there, some people who might be listening and saying, you know, these folks are getting off easy, they should be in jail, they're going into treatment instead, or there are other folks who haven't committed crimes and are struggling to get into treatment. What's your response to that?
Well, having somebody participate in the recovery court program, it gives them an opportunity to cease that particular type of criminal behavior, which is drinking and driving. Folks that are in the program with me, the average stay is about 14 months. So they're going through the treatment, they're going through this rehabilitation process, and it's not easy. It's very difficult for them to be in compliance. They have to meet with probation weekly. They'll come and see me every other week. They have their counseling requirements at Evolution. They have to be employed or do community service. So the process itself is not easy. It's very difficult. And during that time, they are learning how to change their lives. Their lives are turning around for the better. They're getting free of alcohol, which enables them to become, you know, productive in the community. So as opposed to having somebody in jail where you're not being treated, the end result of this is just so much better. And it's not an easy haul for them by any stretch.
How do folks qualify to be in your DWI Recovery Court program?
They will have to have been convicted of a DWI at least one time. We have folks that are in there for their second and third offense. So once they go through the legal process and are found guilty, we get to the sentencing portion and they have the option of coming into the recovery court program or, you know, going to jail.
Hmm. And what happens, you mentioned that they have certain things they have to do. What happens if they don't do them?
So we meet as a group, our recovery court team, which involves the probation officer, treatment, the counselors. They'll meet with the court. We all have staffings, and we go over their progress for the week. So if they have violations, there are sanctions that are imposed. There's a drug court model that deals with how to process sanctions, and you want to start out, you know, with low-level sanctions, community service. Say if folks are not meeting their obligations, they miss a counseling session at Evolution, we discuss it as a group. And we begin the graduated sanctions process, which will ultimately lead up to incarceration in the event they're struggling and not able to be in compliance.
So there are consequences.
Oh, absolutely.
With the support and the treatment. Peter, what is the availability of courts right now? I think, you know, we hear a lot about the state budget. There's a lot of challenges. There's not a lot of money. What does funding look like for drug courts right now across New Mexico?
Well, I'll refer to the Great Recession back in 2008, 2009. That was our high watermark for funding. There was roughly $11 million in general funds dedicated to drug courts statewide. We had about 48, 49 drug courts at that time. We're still at roughly the same number of drug courts, although some have dropped off and new ones have started. But we're down about 15% in our funding since then. And this is not to say that the legislature and the executive branch haven't been supportive of drug courts. They have done their best to try to provide funding through the Great Recession, keep us from closing too many drug court doors, as well as begin to build up the funding. And even during this last legislative session, when there were, again, significant cuts because of the revenue projections for the state, we basically were able to come in at a fairly flat figure. We lost about $300,000 statewide during FY17, but are going into FY18 at a fairly flat budget. With that, down about 15% in funding, we're down about 25% of overall capacity. That's significant. I think there's a couple of ways to look at that. We would like to get back onto the growth curve we were on before the Great Recession. Certainly there is greater need than we are serving. We had about 1,260 people in programs back in 2008. We're down to about 950 on any given day now. But given the fact that roughly 50% by national data of people in jail and prison are clinically addicted, and we have over 13,000 in our prisons and detention centers statewide in New Mexico, that, you know, rough numbers, we're looking at 6,000 potential clients or participants for drug court programs who could benefit from the intensive treatment within a behavior modification program. And we're down around, you know, 900, 1,000. So certainly we could ramp up considerably and do more to help out with this troubled population.
Yeah. And even beyond people who are in jail, there's lots of other people in our communities who are suffering with addiction. Daniel, what can you say, speak to that of, do people need to be committing a crime to get access to treatment?
Well, no. That's one of the ways that, people access help. But I think that there are X number of resources, as you know, and there are a lot of people in New Mexico that I think have ambivalence about seeking treatment. And then there's a portion that really, really want the help. And so it's out of the larger framework of really wanting to be well, to be in balance. And so there are not enough treatment centers, not enough resources currently to serve the need. And so we spend our day trying to think about how to allocate treatment resources, serve the people that need the help. And it's a day-to-day challenge.
That was Daniel Blackwood, Executive Director of the Evolution Group. And before you heard from Peter Bokert, Statewide Drug Court Coordinator in New Mexico, I'd like to go now to Eric in Albuquerque. Eric, I understand you completed a drug court program. What was your experience?
Well, I was in the program. It's been 7 years, a little bit over 7 years now. Of course, it's a drug-mandated program. And my particular experience with it was that it helped me get to the core issues and helped me to realize that in my particular case, drug and alcohol abuse were symptoms, and my real problems were a lot deeper than that. I was, and it's still difficult to talk about it, and I still have to deal with it, you know, because of the things that I went through. I was a sexual abuse victim when I was a kid, and it was through the program that I finally realized that I was acting out, and I came to realize that I thought that I could act with impunity and do things to not only endanger myself, but to endanger my community. And it finally reached a point where I was held accountable and I had structure. And I knew that if I made mistakes, that there would be immediate consequences. But not only that, the Evolution program, the counseling program, helped me to realize that there were some serious core issues that had to be addressed. And through honesty and the willingness to become better and to recover, I was finally given that opportunity in a safe environment in which I could deal with my issues and still feel at the same time that I finally had the structure that I didn't have. And it's been 7 years now, and I really feel that it saved my life, and it saved my family's life, and I'm sure it saved a few lives in the community in which I live. And I'm in full support of it, and it was a great program because of those reasons, because of the structure that was created for me, because of the consequences that I finally had to deal with immediately if I misstepped and made mistakes, and then being given the opportunity to express myself, my feelings, et cetera, in the Evolution Group and the counseling. So it's been a great thing.
Eric,
I'm glad people are talking about it. I'm glad that it still exists. I'm not sure exactly where the conversations are going with I haven't been listening closely. I've just been thinking about what I wanted to say. But I would say, especially to anyone in the program, to be honest and open and willing, as you say, to recover and to become better. And it's been 7 years, and I can honestly say that I have been clean and sober that whole time.
Congratulations on your sobriety, Eric, and thank you so much for sharing your story. It is so difficult to put yourself out there, but I think that probably means a lot to folks who are listening today who are experiencing the same thing or have a loved one who is. So thank you so much for calling in. Daniel, quickly, those deeper problems and issues that he mentioned, that's what you're going for, it sounds like.
Well, I think it's got to be a balanced approach. I mean, I too want to thank Eric for his courage. Warms my heart to see him reach out like that. And it also stokes the mission, which is to try to get people to understand that this adaptive coping mechanism is really the symptom. It's actually the signal that somebody feels out of balance, that their coping mechanism isn't working for them. And it rallies the cry for being able to address, you know, a multitude of underlying issues. And so this model gives us an opportunity to do that. It's wonderful. And it's an interdisciplinary approach where you're teaming with the judge, the probation officer, the assistant district attorney. There's a real embracing, and the public defender, and there's a real embracing of culture. So our approach is informed. It's not just science. It's science-based. But it's also an embracing of cultural differences, the cultures of our area, which is so important to be knowledgeable about. If you don't know or understand a person's cultural context, you're mistreating them. And so it's trauma, it's mental health issues, it's co-occurring disorders, it's the family and cultural context that they come to the fore with, and helping them to find balance again.
Yeah. We're going to talk with Judge Torres about that in just a moment when we come back from a break. This is the KUNM Call-In Show. We do want to hear from you today. Our focus today is drug courts or recovery courts. Do you think the state should spend more on treatment instead of incarceration? Why or why not? Do you wish a drug court program was available for one of your family members or your child or grandchild? What difference do you think it might make in their life if they could go through a drug court program like Eric, who called in just a minute ago? Our number is 877-899-5866. And if you're not comfortable calling today, you can also email your comments to callinshow@kunm.org.
The law firm of Rothstein Donatelli is committed to supporting public radio KUNM. Since 1976, the firm has litigated civil rights, criminal defense, wrongful death, security clearance, and Indian and family law cases throughout New Mexico. RothsteinLaw.com.
Saturday from 9 to 10 a.m. on the Children's Hour. For Foster Child Awareness Month, we'll hear from kids who have been in the system about what it's like. We'll learn more about foster care with New Mexico's Children, Youth, and Families Department Secretary Monique Jacobson and author Rosemary Ziebert, whose book Kit Coyote tells it from the child's point of view. The Children's Hour, this Saturday from 9 to 10 a.m. right here on KUNM.
Violinist Patricia Garcia is adapting to life in Bloomington, Indiana.
I grew up in Cuba and there is no winter. It's really hard for me.
We're getting to know the Vera Quartet, our young artists in residence. They'll play some warm Beethoven for us on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Sarah Gustavus. Our focus today is drug courts across New Mexico. We're joined in studio by Peter Bokert, statewide drug court coordinator, Judge Edward Benavides from DWI Recovery Court in Albuquerque, and Daniel Blackwood, executive director of the Evolution Group. We also have Judge Renee Torres on the line. She's taking over the Urban Native American Healing to Wellness Court program in Albuquerque, and she's a member of Isleta Pueblo. Judge Torres, Daniel just mentioned a moment ago needing to bring in culture into these court programs to consider culture as part of treatment. How is your court going to be doing that?
Well, we're currently doing that, and we've been doing that since the program started. It's very important because a lot of Native Americans, our participants, have lost touch with their Native identity and with their communities and with their culture. And so we've been doing that already. Incorporate traditional and spiritual healing through the providers that work with our participants, First Nations Community Health Source, and the Evolution Group as well. And you heard Daniel Blackwood talk about how important that is. And it really is to meet their emotional, spiritual needs And, you know, the needs of Native Americans are unique to the needs of other individuals. And a lot of times they've become urbanized, these are participants, and lost connection with everything that, you know, that is true to them.
It sounds like that's important, the fact that people are living in an urban area like Albuquerque and not able to maybe visit their tribal community.
Well, it's more than just visiting their tribal community. Native Americans grow up with special beliefs, traditions, different types of healing ceremonies, and just growing up as a community, in a small community that supports each other and helps each other with everything that they go through. Once they become disconnected with their communities, then they lose that, not only the connection to their community, but the support that they get from their communities.
Hmm. And how do folks, what's the process like for people to get into your particular court?
Well, they have to be self-identified Native Americans. They don't need to provide like a CIB card or a proof of blood quantum or anything like that. They just have to self-identify. They have to have at least 2 to 3 DWIs, so they are repeat DWI offenders. And again, it is voluntary, and because there's other options, including other drug court programs or jail. So it is a voluntary program.
Mm. Judge Benavidez mentioned earlier holding people accountable as they're going through the program, that it's not necessarily just easy. You go to counseling and you're done, that there are sanctions, there are requirements. Can you speak a little bit to that as well, about how you balance that supporting people but also holding them accountable in the court system?
Yes, we do use a team approach, as Judge Benavidez stated. And, you know, it is a team of the judge, probation officers, case managers, as well as a prosecutor and public defender attorney. And so when anytime there's an issue with a participant, the team will discuss issues that are happening and decide what steps need to be taken. When they first come into the program, they're in a phase one, and we expect there to be some issues with sobriety. And the main concern, of course, is always community safety. So as long as they're not endangering the community, maybe they've had a slip up in something, we do impose sanctions. The sanctions can be community service, increased treatment, increased maybe AA classes or things like that. And jail is always an option, but we usually reserve jail for the later phases, when the individuals have a higher expectation of them maintaining their sobriety because they've received more services by that time.
Mm. Judge, you're new to this particular Native American Healing to Wellness Court, but you've been a judge for a while, both in your tribe and in the courts here in Albuquerque. What drew you to this particular program? Do you think, how do you see the significance of it for the community more broadly?
Well, it's special to me because I am Native. I relate to the Native participants. I grew up on the reservation, and I know what community is like living on a reservation. I know what their needs are. And I might not specifically relate to some of their issues, but I know where they're coming from. And even just the way we communicate is different as well. And there's always cultural differences, and I feel like I'm able to understand those. And the program is special to me, and as soon as I was elected, I was approached about eventually taking over the program. So I've been shadowing Judge Dominguez for the last 6 months since I started, and I'm excited to take over. It's going to be a great, I think, for the program and for me. I think it gives a lot of meaning to my position here at Metro Court, and I feel like I can incorporate what I know of my traditions and my culture and be able to relate to the participants in a different way that, you know, maybe Judge Dominguez maybe was unable to, and not for lack of her working very hard to. She has brought this program to a great place, and we're very fortunate to have had her leading the program. And so, but I'm happy to take over. I'm excited to take over, and it means a lot to me. I think it's going to be really great for me to do that.
All right, Judge Torres, we're going to keep you with us for a few more minutes. If folks have questions for you, they can call in right now, 877-899-5866. Do you have some questions about how this court works, particularly for Native Americans, how it's working for folks in Albuquerque, and how the system is set up? Again, 877-899-5866. Or do you have other questions about drug courts and how they work around New Mexico? Do you live in a rural community? Are these kinds of courts an option where you live? Do you wish that they were if they're not? Again, the number 877-899-5866. Judge Benavidez, I sat in on your court recently, and one of the things that really struck me is how supportive it seemed. I've been in other courts, and they were not nearly as supportive. Why have you set it up that way, where folks come up, and it's more of a casual check-in and conversation with you every 2 weeks?
I'm really following the drug court model and really trying to incorporate just a holistic approach to everything. So the way it's been turning out, it's been a really supportive process, and we're getting better results as a result of that. Really, when you take away jail as a sanction, ultimately that does happen. But when you allow these folks to really work on treatment and be able to address the issues that they have, this whole sense of just a community amongst themselves seems to come out. And it's very beneficial in the recovery, the support groups that they have, just the overall way the program is running. That's the most effective way to do it that I found, and it's just really been beneficial for all of the participants.
Daniel, we got a question on Twitter this morning. The treatment infrastructure in the state, is it sufficient? We kind of touched on that earlier, but in the context of recovery courts, of taking people in the system and matching them with a community partner who can provide treatment, is that system sufficient right now?
Well, I think we all are pretty well aware of the fact that we don't have sufficient resources. We have good models. We have evolving evidence base. We have ancient wisdom that we're paying attention to, which Judge Torres was just referring to, and that is that, you know, we are wanting to be whole, body, mind, and spirit. It's inside of us. And so the key is to awaken that wholeness that awaits, that lies inside and wants to emerge. And we need more resources to be able to do that for our community members.
Mm. Peter?
Yeah, I just wanted to add to what Daniel was saying in response to your question. The administration, I think, made a great choice back at the beginning of the Affordable Care Act in expanding Medicaid to cover adults with substance abuse issues here in the state. And that has made substance abuse services more readily available because they could be covered by Medicaid in the state. At the same time, we don't have the behavioral health infrastructure to go along with that funding so that we can successfully leverage it as best we can. The behavioral health shakeup that we went through a while back with the 15 providers that were providing like 90% of the Medicaid services statewide, with the accusations of Medicaid fraud that led to many of them closing down, that shakeup, whatever you think of the reasoning behind that or how that fraud investigation was conducted, has led to great instability in the remaining treatment services that are here in the state. We've seen a number of treatment providers come in from, or treatment entities come in from Arizona. I think all but one of them has left the state. And there's been a kind of a difficult scramble. I think our Human Services Department has done an excellent job of trying to maintain services, do no harm throughout. But there is no way to look at that other than disruption for a population that can sorely afford that kind of disruption. What they benefit from is consistency, dependability, accountability, and people that they know are going to be there for them in their time of need. And all of that has been problematic since then.
Yeah, in rural areas, especially where people
especially in rural areas,
travel
correct.
Long distances for care. Judge Benavides, how do you measure success in your courts?
What we're looking at is recidivism rates. So they'll do studies over 1 year periods, and we'll review, you know, the data of folks that have reoffended. Our program to this point, I've been doing this for almost 3 years. We've had 290 graduates. To this point, we have had 3 folks that have actually picked up a new DWI offense and reoffended. When you look at that number compared to folks that would not be getting treatment and were incarcerated, it's going to be, you know, much, much higher. You're going to have repeat offenders that are not being treated. So that's the goal of any drug court program, the recidivism. And those are the statistics that are compiled to measure, I guess, the success of the program. So to this point, we've been doing really well on that front.
We have someone who also wants to ask a question on that issue as well. Nancy in Albuquerque, what's your question on drug courts?
Actually, that was my question. I wanted to answer it in terms of what outcomes were. I would like to follow up with, though, are there long-term studies For these particular folks with the results that you're describing, what's the longevity of that recovery and those outcomes?
Great question. Peter, can you speak to research on this area?
I'd be happy to try to answer that. Drug courts are perhaps the most researched criminal justice intervention of them all. So there is a wealth of information on not just what makes drug courts work, but the outcome studies as to their cost effectiveness, their effectiveness at reducing the reoffense rate. Here in New Mexico, we use a recidivism measure where we look at the prior three years of people who've left the program. This is what's called an intent to treat model. In other words, we don't just look at the successful graduates of the program and see if they have reoffended. We look at everybody who went through the program, and that's going to include those who absconded after 2 days in the program, after they realized this was more difficult than they'd expected. It was going to require behavior change that they weren't up to, including those who stayed maybe 3 months, maybe 9 months, and successfully graduated. And for our DWI drug courts statewide, of which we have 9, the intent to treat recidivism rate is only 7.9%. By the last fiscal year. So that means that 7.6%, my apologies. That means that only 7.6% of all those who went through the DWI drug courts over a three-year period picked up another DWI arrest. So that is a significant outcome measure, a highly successful outcome measure. We don't have a fact or a figure to compare that to. But it does show us that we're being, a specific study that says, well, if they hadn't been in DWI drug court, here is the likely reoffense rate. But we all know from the news and our own experiences that there are many people out there who continue to drive drunk, commit repeat DWIs. And unless we can intervene with them successfully, and what I'm suggesting is that DWI drug court is one very successful way to intervene, they are likely to continue to put public safety at risk, not to mention their own public health or their own health with continuing to drink and drive.
Lots of folks are concerned about repeat DWI offenders here in New Mexico. Is that a concern for you? Do you think drug courts, recovery courts are the answer? Or do you have another idea? 877-899-5866. I'm going to go back to our judges today. They need to get going in a few minutes to get to their court schedule. Judge Torres from Urban Native Healing to Wellness Court, anything you want to add about how your court connecting with the community and helping Native Americans deal with DWI?
Well, our goal is to achieve long-term sobriety and to help participants get back on the right path, mainly with their sobriety, but also with employment, education, their health, and their families. And we believe that if we can help them holistically to achieve all of these goals and to get healthy and get employed and have a stable life, then we will be able to achieve the long-term sobriety. It's very important not just to the individuals themselves, but their families, to the community, the safety of the larger community. And Native Americans make up about 5% of the Albuquerque population. There are about 55,000 urban natives that live in Albuquerque. So it is important, and we believe that our program really helps them. And if they want to make a life change, the Healing to Wellness program is a great place to be.
Judge Torres, thank you so much for sharing those details about the program today. And we'll put a link up on our website at KUNM.org if folks want to get more information about your particular court.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here today. Judge Benavidez, let's end with a comment from you as well. The broader need for the community, how do you speak to that with folks who are coming through your court system?
Well, one example I can give you, when I first started, I've been a judge now going on 9 years. And I can recall specifically, I wasn't on the drug court team. I was just, handling cases, processing cases. I had an individual, it was his third DWI offense. I sentenced him to a year in jail. And 2-3 weeks later, he got out and killed somebody afterwards. So had this individual had the opportunity to go through the program, the results are just so astounding. It's such a community safety factor that everybody needs to understand and get behind these programs because they do work. They're very successful, and it is just a tremendous safeguard for the community.
Judge Benavidez, thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
We're going to go to break now. This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Sarah Gustavus. We do want to hear from you today, 877-899-5866. If you have questions about drug courts or if you want to react to what you've heard today, again, that number is 877-899-5866. We are KUNM News on Twitter, and you can also email your comments to callinshow@kunm.org.
It's not pie in the sky to think you may win a whole pie from Pioneer in Pie Town, because they've just offered 4 pies to KUNM listeners to encourage you to support us again. And Motorcycles 505 in Albuquerque donated a motorized bicycle that goes 30 miles per hour and gets 100 miles per gallon. Open your mailing or go to KUNM.org to learn more. If you gave and registered during our spring fundraising season, you are already entered. 5 winners drawn on May 31st.
There are old laws still on the books that are outdated and in some cases offensive to Native Americans. For example, one law allows the government to place Native children in boarding schools without parental consent. One senator is pushing legislation to change such laws. We'll explore all of this on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. Our focus this morning is drug courts in New Mexico. We have a comment from Adrian on Twitter. He says, harm reduction policies are good for New Mexico's communities and state budget. Return on investment on treatment is larger than that of incarceration. Also, we're going to take a question now. We have an anonymous caller who has a question for us. What would you like to ask?
Yes, I'd like to ask your panel, what is protection, how one can be protected against the abuses of the probation system. Our son was never offered a drug court, and he was hospitalized. He almost died in a coma. And during the time the probation system wished to come and get him out of the hospital, which doctors stopped happening, and so we hid him when he was released so he could continue. He was seeing 5 doctors. And during that period, he racked up another offense, and he became a felon. And we'd like to know how there could have been some protection against the abuses of probation.
I think it's a challenging question to answer. But, Daniel, can you speak to this? It can be so complicated, the court system and people who are struggling with addiction. Can you speak to that?
Well, first of all, my heart goes out to the caller and for her loss. And I appreciate the question very much. I mean, I think that this model that we're talking about this morning represents, probably the cutting edge of what we can do as a society to try to address this social issue in a thoughtful and cost-effective way that has good results. And so there are people that are in the criminal justice system that are not receiving the benefits of that model. And of course, we're here this morning to try to get the word out about it and to help people understand why it's more effective. So as a treatment provider, I would love to see this model be more available to see it grow in New Mexico. For someone that is in the system that isn't able to partake in the model, what they can do is seek support for many of the features of it. So, one of its cornerstones is treatment. Another cornerstone is really looking at risk factors. So a really good assessment that looks at the overall functioning and the whole picture of the individual helps that person and their family members to know what they really need. And then they can advocate as the system can advocate for those issues getting addressed. As Peter referred to earlier, we just need more behavioral health resources to meet the need.
Yeah. What's different when you're working with someone who's coming to you, to the Evolution Group, through the Recovery Court program versus coming on their own? Is there a difference in the clinical approach?
Well, I think the treatment is very much the same. I think that an individual coming in on their own, and so we're dealing with the phenomenon of self-motivation versus when a person comes through the program, their motivation is staying out of jail. But that's a motivator, and I don't discount motivation. Motivation is, you know, it's the secret sauce in this whole thing. And so what we do is try to enhance motivation in our approaches. If they're, you know, court referred, we'll take the motivation that they start with, and we try to help them discover, you know, deeper inner motivations for wanting to be well.
Do you find that the people do tap into that, whether it's their kids or their business or something else for them?
Oh, that's what makes the whole thing tick for me, is when I'm sitting with someone and they can see it, I can see it, we can feel what their deep motivations are. And when you tap that, there's no end to how people can change and grow.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier this hour, people who have experienced trauma who are dealing with that years later. We have a comment from a caller who couldn't stand the line but said she's a teacher, underage drinking prevention, that we need to start with educating young kids like in fifth and sixth grade, and there should be funding for that. Do you see that, that the people you're dealing with, that these issues go way, way back in their own life?
Absolutely. I think that everyone probably intuits that that's where a lot of trauma originates. When we're little and the world seems scary, that's the seedlings of how people develop adaptive responses. And so what she's saying, I think, is she'd love to see it in the curriculum, that young people are taught about this and how they can, you know, being taught coping mechanisms, responses to things that are scary, to situations that are difficult, or how they can help themselves. And I think that would be wonderful.
Do you have a comment or question you'd like to add about drug courts today? The number, there's still time to get in, is 877-899-5866. Again, that's 877-899-5866. You can also send us a tweet. We are KUNM News on Twitter. And Peter, what about... Actually, Daniel, I'm sorry. I'm going to stay with you for just a moment. What about relapses? How are those handled in the courts that you work with?
So a relapse is also a signal for the individual, and it's saying that I've lost focus, or I'm needing my treatment plan changed a little bit, help, because I'm going back to what it is I used to do. And so relapse, as much as we don't want to see it occur, is an opportunity to look at what needs tweaking and how we might be able to approach this. And so what we're doing is we're helping that individual to build resilience, to know what to do, people, places, and things, how to manage themselves, skills to do that. And so relapse prevention is a really important set of skills and understandings to teach. We actually have an app called My Evolution that's free. It's a relapse prevention app, and people can get on that app. They can journal. They can record the voice of their sponsor saying something inspiring to them that they can play back to themselves. The back end of the app is an urge surfing feature where if you might be in the middle of urging, craving, thinking about wanting to use or drink, and you can actually engage this urge surfing. Urge surfing is the idea of learning how to work with urges and cravings rather than just saying, no, I won't do that, which, of course, makes it stronger. And by learning to surf, that idea of moving with the wave of an urge, of a craving, gives people the opportunity to practice manageability, to practice trying to work and sit with an urge or a craving rather than fight it.
Now, so are you encouraging them to do something else or to give them some space to think about that urge? What does that mean?
I like your
exactly?
idea of giving them space. Yeah, it's the idea that rather than just be rigid with it, to try to work with that feeling, to work with the skills that they've learned, to give themselves breathable room, to try to sit back and observe the craving, the urge, the thinking. And so the metaphor of surfing comes to mind, where instead of like taking the wave head on of an urge, you either go under it or you try to move with it and practice that. So people that are learning how to recover from addiction are really practicing how to be with this adaptive response that they've had so long, and the trauma or the issues that go underneath that, and how to work with themselves in a whole way. That takes practice. That takes patience. It takes encouragement. It also takes accountability, frankly. I think that to get back to your other question, when you have accountability, it helps us who aren't struggling with addiction to be accountable for our practices.
Yeah, and life is challenging. Life is challenging for everybody.
Oh, yeah.
We have another caller who has a question for us this hour. Andrea in Albuquerque, what would you like to ask about drug courts? Andrea?
Hi, yes. Hi. I wanted to know what happens to the original charges if they're dismissed or if they can be expunged before they ordinarily would be. When the person successfully completes a treatment program, I know that would help them with jobs.
Yeah. Peter, can you answer that for us?
Yes. Normally the carrot, as we call it, is the reduction in the potential sentence. Most drug courts operate on a post-adjudication, post-sentence, post-plea basis, so they've pled guilty to the charge. So that charge is going to be on part of their record going forward. And actually, the drug court, this idea of coerced treatment, actually has proven to be quite effective. It's not the old way of thinking of treatment, people coming in voluntarily. But the coerced treatment, court-ordered treatment, can be quite effective. It allows the court to use the leverage of its authority to get the participant to more fully engage in their treatment, which can lead to a more successful treatment intervention. But the actual sentence then, if they successfully complete the program, they'll go back to the referring judge on the original charge, and the judge will take their successful completion of the drug court program into consideration before handing down the final sentence. So basically, mandatory minimums will still have to be served, like for a DWI, the ignition interlock, and the different levels of time in detention. But the time on probation can be eliminated as time served in the drug court, and that can then determine that they do not get sentenced to ongoing year or more of probation. So it's a reduction in the sentence. It's not an elimination of the charge, though.
Thanks, Peter. We also have Claire in Albuquerque who wants to share her story. Claire, what would you like to share with us today?
I went through an intensive outpatient program. I was not court mandated, but there were many people in there who were. And two things that just opened my eyes. Number one, the extent, particularly of heroin users, who it's not only their moms and dads and aunts and uncles, it's their grandparents and their great aunts and great uncles. So they get out, and they go back to that community, and it is so hard, so difficult for them. And I had no idea that it went that far back. And the second thing is there were people in there who they were self-motivated. They wanted to be clean and sober, but they were not allowed psychological services unless they came in dirty. And so they went out and used in order to get into the program.
Hmm. Clara, that is tough. Thank you for sharing that with us today. Daniel, you want to react to that?
Well, I'm just thinking about Claire's experience and taking it in. I'm sure that all kinds of things occur and that people have to be scrappy about how they access services. We have a serious situation in New Mexico where there are wait lists at really every behavioral health organization. So I'm sure that there's a group of people that are feeling like they really desperately need help. And as Peter was alluding to earlier, and so that's where we, as a community, can grow, is to develop more resources for people that are actually able now to seek help. And I do believe that there are efforts afoot, both at the local and statewide level, to try to get that to occur. And so I'm hopeful that we'll see that going forward.
Yeah. I think one question that it's on my mind and I might be on other people's minds is, can everyone achieve sobriety and maintain it? Is that possible for everyone?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. I mean, I wouldn't want to throw water onto the fire that says that, you know, there are people that can't. There are people who are late stage that just have a multitude of physical, you know, mental, emotional, and addiction issues, spiritual issues, that would find that incredibly challenging. But I think that even for them, there's light. And so we might have to work harder, we might have to dig in more, but I wouldn't give up on anyone.
Yeah. And do you think that we've had some callers who mentioned young people and reaching out to young people. Is there a prevention side of this that we also need to be talking about moving forward?
Well, I'm not a prevention specialist, but I do see the wisdom in trying to address this earlier on. I think that by addressing this as a health issue, teaching wellness, doing outreach with young people, helping their families to get stronger, that's prevention in and of itself.
Yeah. Peter, did you want to comment on that as well?
Yes. Drug courts, basically the court system has to meet people where they are. They come in addicted. They come in with, quite a charge list, multiple crimes committed. So we work with them not at the prevention standpoint, but, treatment counselors try to meet people where they are and then work with them from that point. The courts have to work with them as they are the ultimate realists in that regard. So prevention is not part of the court's mandate. That's just not where we intersect with the population, unfortunately. But there are many prevention programs at large out there. I know the liquor excise tax, about a significant portion of it is diverted to help, and not all of it, but a significant portion of it is targeted towards education and prevention programs at the county level. And many of those turn into outreach to the schools to try to teach children about the problems with alcohol, drinking and driving, drug abuse. But the significant issue that crops up was referred to by that earlier caller. You can have an individual who goes to school and learns something from a prevention program, an educational outreach, and then goes home to a multi-generational heroin distribution system where grandma is actually running the operation. So they are in school for a short period of time. They're at home for the major part of the time, and certainly home is going to be a significant behavior indicator for that child. And that can be just a really difficult challenge for that child to overcome. They're learning one thing at school, seeing something completely different at home. This is their family, their extended family. And that's what we find with juvenile drug courts at times, that some of the juveniles, the only way for them to be successful is to reach age of maturity and leave that community, because in that environment, they really don't stand much of a chance.
Peter, that's a really important point, and we are going to be looking at juveniles in a show next month. We're working on that right now to focus specifically on young people who are in recovery courts around the state. Daniel Blackwood, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Sarah.
Peter Bokert. We were also joined by Judge Torres and Judge Benavides from Metro Court in Albuquerque earlier this hour. We'll put links to everyone's organizations on our website, newmexicoinfocus.org. The conversation doesn't have to end here. Find KUNM News on Twitter or go to the KUNM News call-in show page at KUNM.org and share your comments there. I'm Sarah Gustavus. I'm also the producer of New Mexico in Focus on New Mexico PBS. Join us Friday night at 7 to learn more about the DWI Recovery Court program in Bernalillo County. Marino Spencer was our engineer today. Sarah Trujillo screened your calls. And Rashad Mahmoud produced today's show. Alain Baumgartel is our executive producer. This is 89.9 KUNM. Have a great rest of your day.